Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or DSL Extreme. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, April Fool's Day, 2007, on the Premier Radio Networks. This is show 340. Well, a good day to you, everybody. Leo Laporte here. I am
the Tech Guy, and this is the show we talk about tech every week, right here. It's not a computer show. Whoa, hold on, slow down. I used to do them for years. Starting in 1990, I started talking about computers on the radio. Back then, that's when a computer was a computer. Yeah. Windows 3.0, DOS 6, or maybe it was 5.5. But a lot's changed since then, and really, this is a technology show. It ain't a computer show anymore. No, sirree, Bob. We talk about cell phones. There's a great story in the Sunday Times about cell phone. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Cell phone barcode readers. Really interesting. We talk about home theater. That coming up a little later this hour. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater expert, is going to talk about speaker placement. That's technology, you betcha. It's going to be a little math involved, too, I understand. Uh-oh. We talk about gadgets, of course, like MP3 players and PDAs. Well, if anybody ever comes out with something better than the iPod, you'll hear it here first. That kind of thing. This is where you can keep up on what's happening. And I tell you, it's a full-time job for me. But I do it so you don't have to. You could just sit back, relax, and once a week you listen to me, and then you're set. You heard something you're interested in, you want to know more about? There's even a phone number you can call. 888-ASK-LEO. That's 888-827-5536. There's a website, techguylabs.com, where we bring you all the information from our deep, in-depth research into the world of technology, techguylabs.com. And this is Sunday's show, episode 340. If you want to follow along in the home version of our game. There's also a chat room, which is a lot of fun. There's only 90 people in there right now, including the moderators, but it'll get a little busy in a next hour or so. Chat room does not require any additional software. You can just go to the webpage, click the chat link, and the software is there. But you can also, if you have IRC software, that's the kind of chat we use, the original chat, the real deal. Chat, real chat for real geeks. You can point your chat client, whether it's XChat or Merc, Colloquy for the Mac. You could point that to dslextreme.com. And the room is the Pound Tech Guy room. irc.dslextreme.com, Pound Tech Guy. That's the server name. Big news. From Google. Did you go to the front page of Google today? Wow. I don't think anybody expected this. This came out of left field. No big announcement. Just suddenly, boom, you go to Google.com and there it is. Google TISP. TISP. T-I-S-P. Oh, and I tell you, this changes everything. I don't know if I can do this with a straight face. Welcome to Google TISP. You can see it. Google.com/TISP. Sign up for our free, get this, free in-home wireless broadband service. Sick of paying for broadband that you have to, well, pay for? Introducing Google TISP beta, like everything Google does. Our new free in-home wireless broadband service. Sign up today. We'll send you your TISP self-installation kit and listen to what you get free. a setup guide, fiber optic cable, spindle, wireless router, and installation CD. I think that's when I started to realize there was something afoot. I hadn't had my cup of coffee yet, so it took me a little while. The fiber optic cable, kind of, that's when I thought, Tispin Home Wireless Broadband is free, fast, and highly reliable. Easy to install, just takes minutes, and it's vacuum sealed to prevent water damage. Interested? Learn more about TISP via the links below. Now, it's a little suspicious because they have a picture of a woman with her son. They're pointing at their computer, which is, by the way, clearly a Mac, but they've airbrushed out the Apple logo. But it looks like they're in the bathroom. That's the toilet sitting right. I don't know. That's a little weird. Well, not really, because that's how TISP works. It goes through your local municipal sewage lines. Read on for all the fun. Yes, it's April Fool's Day. You figured that out, did you? Google's known for their April Fool's jokes. Now, by the way, that's the last joke on this show from me that isn't clearly labeled. I don't have the energy to make up a whole bunch of fake tech stories to try to fool you with. And that kind of, it always bugs me when I get pranked like that. My wife does it every year, and it never fools me, but it's so sweet because it's so badly done that it doesn't fool me. See, I don't get angry because she comes in and says, Aunt Matilda died and left us a fortune. Actually, she's smarter than that. She says $123,000, you know, some number. Sounds more real. The first time, I don't think we were married yet, I said, I didn't know you had an Aunt Matilda. And she managed to pull it off for a while. But now, see, I know there's no Aunt Matilda, so it doesn't fool me. After 20 years, it's hard to pull off an April Fool's joke, you know, with your husband. Google's been doing a lot of these. I mean, they've got some, there's a whole lot, you know, here's one. I can't tell if this is an earlier April Fool's joke or this is current. About Gmail paper. Gmail is their web-based email, right? You click, we stack. You get, she's getting this giant box that says Gmail on it. Yes, the cost of postage is offset with the help of relevant, targeted, unobtrusive advertisements, which will appear on the back of your Gmail paper prints in red, bold, 36-point Helvetica. No pop-ups, no flashy animations. These are physically impossible in the paper medium. What about my attachments? All part of the deal. Photo attachments are printed on high-quality glossy photo paper and secured to your Gmail paper with a paperclip. MP3 and WAV files will not be printed. And we recommend maintaining copies of your non-paper Gmail in these cases. Is there a limit? You can make us print 1,000, or 100,000 of your emails. It's whatever seems reasonable to you. I love it. I would guess, there's so many smart people at Google, you know, working there. I would guess that there's a lot of competition there to come up with the funniest, best, you know, wackiest, most believable, and yet most outrageous April Fool's jokes. I would guess. Anyway, it's just my guess. What are you doing for April Fool's? You can tell us now. It's okay. I know you didn't want to say anything earlier, but you can tell us now. What are you doing for April Fool's? Got any good jokes planned? We talked a little bit about great April Fool's pranks. Some of them are kind of mean, actually. You know, I mean, you know, I like the ones that aren't mean. Somebody in the chat room said, "I'm just going to replace my girlfriend's hard drive with an ME installation. So when she boots up, she'll be." That's mean. That's mean. We used to, when in the old days when mice had rolling balls in them, it was a great prank to play on the office, is to go through the office and remove the rolling balls, because a mouse in every other way seems normal, but you're moving it around and nothing's happening, and really it seems like it's broken, like there's something really wrong with it. Of course there's not. And somewhere somebody has a drawer full of mouse balls just... I guess that's kind of mean. What are you planning for April Fool's? I'd like to hear about it. 8888 Ask Leo. This is not a joke. This is serious. Good, interesting story on the front page of the Sunday Times. barcodes for your cell phones. Apparently, they're doing it big time in Asia. In Japan, for instance, if you're at a McDonald's, you can point your cell phone at the wrapper on your hamburger and get nutrition information on the cell phone screen. It's all done with barcodes. Now, you have to have a phone with a camera, a cell phone with a camera in it. You can download software now that works with many American cell phones. The problem is nobody's using them, so you won't see a lot of these yet. I think it's probably, I don't know. You know, we've seen this before. Remember the QCAT? Do you remember that? It was free or very cheap. You'd get them at Radio Shacks, and the idea was advertisers would put barcodes in their magazines. You would scan them, you know, in their ads. You'd scan them with the QCAT, and then you'd run to your computer. You'd plug in the QCAT, and your browser would suddenly launch a bunch of pages. See, right there, you know, that doesn't sound like anything anybody'd want. Oh, I'm so interested in this advertisement. I'm going to scan it and go to my computer to get more information? No. And it was a flop. In fact, the best thing that came out of the QCAT was people were able to hack it and do all sorts of interesting things. But now this maybe isn't such a big difference, but I think that in some ways it is, because first of all, we all have the cell phones. If the software comes with a cell phone, as it does in many countries outside the U.S., it's kind of automatic. HP's trying to push it here in the States. And if you're interested, I'll tell you what, I'll put the link in the show notes to the software. You can download it. It works on many phones. You have to have a camera. In Japan, they use paperless airline tickets. You just put the code on your cell phone. Bring your phone. Boom. That's kind of cool. In the Philippines, ads in the newspaper have barcodes in them. Same thing in Britain. You scan the code and then you see videos on your cell phone. See, that's the thing. That's the difference. You see it right away on your cell phone or information on your cell phone. Bare Naked Ladies put the codes on their concert posters last fall. What do you think? Think that's a good idea? Hey, let's go to the phones. 8888 Ask Leo. It's your turn to talk. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. We're talking about high tech right now, and I'd love to hear from you. Talk about your problems, your solutions, your questions, your comments, your suggestions. Paul in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome. Leo Laporte here. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Hey, I've been a fan of yours since the early days of Call for Help and Screensaver. So I've a long time, and I've really enjoyed everything you've taught me, and you've got me out of more than one jam.
Thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure. I really am lucky to be able to do this. I love it.
Hey, I've got a question. I'm going to be moving from a PC to a Mac, and just not going to do the whole Vista thing. I'm pretty much going to avoid it. I'm just going to go ahead and go to a Macintosh. And what I've been doing is I've been moving files that I want to save over to an external networked hard drive. And recently I found out, after doing some reading, that Mac cannot read or write to an NTFS format, and that's what it's formatted in.
Not so. It can read NTFS if you have Tiger. You have to have 10.4.
Okay.
Which you probably do. If you get a new Mac, you will, for sure.
Yeah,
and it just can't write it.
Okay.
So you'll
Am
be able to
have problems with it?
Well, you won't be able to write to it, but you won't have any trouble at all reading it. So if you're using it as a way of transferring files over, that's fine.
Okay.
If you then want to back up to it from a Mac, you should reformat it to the Mac file format, HFS.
Am I going to have to pull everything off to do that, or can I just
yes.
Some type of format?
No, there's no way to convert it.
Really? Because I've got like 50 gigs of stuff on there before I realized what was going on.
Now, wait a minute, though. It's a network drive, or is it a locally connected drive?
No, it's locally connected on my network, but it's actually hooked through an Ethernet.
Oh, then it's fine. Then it doesn't matter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the network translates the format. That's how networking started, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the whole point of networking, is that you don't care what file format the drive supports.
Oh, okay. So
it only matters if you have a locally connected drive, USB or FireWire, or internal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I won't have to do anything at all?
No, it'll look just like a regular drive. I don't even know. You know, I back up to a network-attached storage. That's what these things are called. I have a terabyte in-front server sitting over in the corner there. It's running Linux. I know that much. I have no idea what the file format is, and I don't care. And I write and read to all the time from Windows and Mac.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Nothing to worry about. Can I ask another quick question?
Sure.
Hey, I have a program. It's called iSound, and on my PC right now. And what it does is, a lot of times I'll get audiobooks on tape, and I use my cassette deck to be able to transfer that over to MP3 format. And that's basically all it does, and it's got a scheduled format, and you can do stuff like that. Is there anything like that available in open source for the Mac? Or?
Oh, I'm sure there is. Let me try to understand what you're doing. So you have a cassette player that's hooked up to your computer?
Correct, yes.
And iSound records it as MP3, basically?
Yes.
Does it control the cassette deck as well?
No. Just does it.
You just play and record.
Into the line in, yeah.
Oh, well, that's just really recording software. I mean, it doesn't have to be... Does it do anything fancy? Like
No, the only thing it really does that I like is it has the ability to schedule, and you can also do, if you have gaps in it, it'll stop the current MP3 and start a new one.
Yeah, that's called auto cuts or auto track sensor.
Yeah, is there anything like that available for the Mac? I'd like a free open source, but I'm willing.
Well, Audacity is free open source. It doesn't have, the one thing it's missing is that automatic track separation. But, you know, the truth is, if you look at the waveform as you're recording, you'll see it. It's pretty clear. Oh, it went away for two seconds, and now there's another track. It makes it very, and it's very easy to cut it up. I also use, if that's a free one, and it's open source, Audacity, A-U-D. It's open source for Windows, Mac, and Linux. A-U-D-I-C-I-T-Y. It's a really nice little program. It's also audio editing, and it has processing. You can have hiss reduction, equalization, that kind of thing. And then there's a commercial program that I like a lot that might be a little easier for it. It's only $40, called Amadeus, like Mozart, A-M-A-D-E-U-S, Amadeus Pro. That's a really good little piece of software, but that's not free.
And that has a scheduler built in?
Scheduler. Let me think about the scheduler. So how would it schedule it?
Well, what it does is sometimes on cassettes you'll have some that are 45 minutes per side or some that are like 23.
Oh, I see. So it knows when it's over.
Yeah, to stop.
Yeah, no, I don't, I'm sure there is. I just don't know of one. So it's automatically detecting tracks, and then it knows that it's finished somehow.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. That's not really a scheduler. It's probably just listening. Oh, I don't hear anything more. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't know of anything like that, but, you know, that's not a big deal. Say you record an extra 30 minutes of silence. It's literally a click and a delete, and you're done. So I think that you probably, while those are, you know, handy features, it's not the end of the world if you don't have them. And I'm thinking that probably somebody will come up with something that does that on the Mac. I don't know of one off the top of my head, but I'm sure there is. When I dub cassettes, I do the same thing. Actually, I use a cassette deck that actually goes in the PC called the Plus Deck. It's a IDE. It's the same size as a hard drive. And it slides in, then you can screw it down. And so now you have a little cassette opening in your computer. It's a little bit of a kludge. It doesn't actually, you know, you have to have it pass through the back of the computer into the sound card because it doesn't have any recording capabilities. And it has a serial port controller, but the software does at least flip the cassette over, and so you press one button, it records the whole thing, it will separate tracks. That's a nice, that Plus Deck is great. I think it's about $89, but that's Windows only, not a Mac, unfortunately. I'm sorry to say. It's interesting. This is how networking started. Actually, it was a guy at the Defense Department who said, my two computers right next to each other can't talk to each other, how do we solve that? And they invented the internet and networking. Leo Laporte, I am the Tech Guy, home theater, coming up.
Yeah, exactly.
From the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California, I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. So glad you're with us today. As we do every week, we'd like to check in with the AV geek, Mr. That's what I'm going to call you, Scott. I hope you don't mind.
Scott a bit.
And it's got, you know, for those of, you know, the earliest form of geekery, well, maybe not the earliest. There have probably been geeks since the first caveman said, no, you guys go out hunting. I'm going to see if I can invent the wheel here. But I'm busy. But the geeks of my generation weren't computer geeks, and yours too, because computers really were inaccessible, giant, expensive things. We were AV geeks.
Mm-hmm.
We were the kids on the AV squad who went around with a strip projector. And then worked lighting tech in the drama club and all that stuff.
Yep. I was one of those geeks, all right.
Yeah, see? So it doesn't end. He is a video editor for, and I realized last week when I called you the video editor, it sounds like you might be editing video. It's in the terms of editing writing. He's a writer.
Yes, it's a very common mistake that people make. Yes, exactly.
He's a writer for the Perfect Vision magazine, which I'm coming to like more and more, especially since you can download it free from avguide.com, and you can read Scott's writings there. Every week we talk about, I've been really enjoying this, a little bit of technology so that you can, you know, make your HDTV experience better. And one thing people ask me a lot is about speakers, but maybe you can help me set up my speakers.
Sure. Well, there are a number of guidelines that one can follow. First of all, I would say, whenever possible, try to avoid the sound coming from the TV itself. As you said, TVs are stereo these days. There's two speakers, and some of them try to put woofers in there, or even what they might call subwoofers for low frequencies. But the sound from just about any TV is not going to be very good, certainly not compared to speakers that you place around in your room. In terms of a bedroom TV or something like that, then it's perfectly fine. But if you're really interested in immersing yourself in the experience, having a separate surround sound system is so important. Many people in my industry even say that the sound is at least as important, if not more so, than the picture.
A director will tell you that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's everything in the movie.
Exactly. In terms of creating an immersive experience, a suspension of disbelief where you really feel like you're there in the action. And so having a surround sound system is very important, and I always recommend it. And positioning your speakers is also pretty important and pretty critical for getting a good sound. If you put your speakers in sort of the wrong place in the room, and depending on where you're sitting, you can hear frequencies that aren't there that should be there. You can hear frequencies that are accentuated more than they should be, peaks and troughs, or peaks and valleys, or nodes they're sometimes called. So placing the speakers in the room in the right way can really improve the experience for you. Now, in terms of the main speakers, the front, right, left, and center, and the surround speakers, the ideal place to put them is at even fractions of the room's length, width, and height.
You didn't tell me there'd be math involved.
Not very much.
Even fractions. You mean like one half, one quarter, one eighth?
Precisely. Okay. Precisely. At even fractions, so I typically use a sixth or an eighth of the room's length and width and height.
And why do you do that?
Well, you don't want to get too much into math now, do you?
Oh, go ahead. You're the AV geek. Go ahead.
I am an AV geek. It's true. Well, it turns out that even fractions, eighths, sixths, fourths, and so on, tend to minimize the number of places where, well, you have to understand that sound reflects, right? It emanates out of the speaker, it reflects off the walls and the floor and the ceiling.
Bose made a good living doing that for years.
Yes. The Bose 901, I remember
it well. The direct reflecting subwoofer. They didn't call it subwoofer, but that's what it was.
Yeah, exactly. And so as the sound reflects around the room and bounces off the walls and the ceiling and the floor, there are points at which crests of the wave, that is, maximum points of the sound wave, meet and reinforce each other and get louder. And there are points where they cancel each other.
Where
there are other points
where
they cancel.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Precisely right. And so it turns out that, generally speaking, this is not a hard and fast rule, but generally speaking, placing the sound source at even fractions of the room's dimensions will minimize these sorts of additive and cancellative.
You don't want either one. You want it to be flat. You don't want it to be boosted, and you don't want it
exactly.
to be cut. So if I
exactly
have,
right.
if I have a room that is, let's say, 10 feet by 10 feet to make it easier for me because I'm not a math geek, and so I would do 1/6 of 10 feet apart or distance from the TV?
A distance from the wall.
From the wall, 1/6 in.
Yeah, 1/6 in, exactly.
Okay.
1/8 in. Now, I will say this, a square room, such as you describe, is going to be extremely difficult. And even placing the speakers in those positions isn't going to be really good.
Most rooms are rectangular. But why is
most rooms are rectangular.
A square room is difficult because of the echoes reinforcing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because the reinforcements are symmetrical.
Right.
And so no matter where you place it, you're going to get some of these reinforcements and cancellations because of the symmetry of the room. So ideally, you want a room that is rectangular. and there are all sorts of acoustical calculations that one can do. And in fact, if you're really serious about it, you hire an acoustician to come in and evaluate your room, because not only is the speaker placement important, but also acoustical treatments, that if you have a square room, you can improve it to some degree by placing absorbers and diffusers and other acoustical treatments on the walls and the ceiling. But
I think
ideally,
that's what that guy did from Germany. I mean, he had a little meter and he was going around and positioning things.
Yep. Ideally, what you want to do, if you're building a theater from scratch, you want to consult an acoustician and get the ideal room dimensions, which will minimize these cancellations and reinforcements. Right. And then put your speakers at even fractions, 1/8, 1/4, 1/6, something like that, of the room's length, width, and height, and you're really going to be in Fat City.
So if I have a room that is 10 feet wide, the television's right in the middle, and obviously where the TV is also impacts this, I guess, but let's say I put the TV right in the middle. I would put the left and right channels 6/10 of a foot.
Well, 6/10, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of a foot, 1/6 of the 10 feet, whatever that is. That's
correct, whatever that is, yeah.
1.4, whatever it is.
1 point feet. Some feet, yeah.
In
yeah.
from the side walls.
Right, okay. And in from the back wall.
And, okay, so not merely from the sides, but also from the front and the back.
Correct.
So
correct.
It's kind of in a triangle a little bit, okay. At an angle.
Exactly.
Okay. So you
now ideally,
all right, I get it.
Ideally, you need to take the height of the room into consideration as well, but that's often. I know.
I was doing well. Okay.
You know, ideally, you want to do that, but more often than not, it's not.
Don't you
practical.
Want just want them at ear height, pretty much for the at least because the high end stuff is very directional, right? You want it the same.
Exactly. Height. Yes. Yes. Exactly. The front speakers you want at ear height. Now the rear speakers, the surround speakers, generally speaking, you want them higher than ear height, because the surround speakers are so often meant for sound effects and ambience. And you want that sound field to not be pointed, you know, right at your ear, so you're getting
it's
a
too
strong
loud.
Sense of
and
it's too directional.
Right. Then it'll
you
be right behind you, yeah.
Right next to you or right behind you. You'd like them up a little higher than ear height, ideally.
So you don't want it too directional, just kind of ambient.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the subwoofer, the speaker that produces the low frequencies, is also very critical where you place that. You can place it along a wall. You probably should. To reinforce the bass, in particular, it generally does things like explosions and rocket blast off and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You want it to rumble, but you don't want it to be too loud. And a friend of mine, a master acoustician actually at Harman International, the company behind JBL and Harman Kardon and a bunch of companies, his name is Floyd Toole, wonderful guy, an excellent, really smart guy. And he did some studies and found that placing the subwoofer at the half or quarter point along one wall is really the best in terms of avoiding or minimizing, I should say, these reinforcements and cancellations. And he found that not only that placing two subwoofers at one along one wall and one along an adjoining wall even does better. It's to smooth out the bass.
Okay. So that's I thought it didn't matter because the bass is so non-directional. You could just put it like anywhere under the coffee table, under the sofa, anywhere. It didn't matter. But
It's non-directional. But the wavelength of bass sounds is pretty loud and long, I should say. And rooms very often can very easily reinforce those frequencies at certain positions in the room, so that you sit in one place and you can't hear any bass at all, and you sit in another place and that's all you hear.
Fantastic.
Which brings me to the final point, which is where to place your seats for the best acoustical sound. And interestingly enough, it turns out you want to place your seats, generally speaking, at odd fractions of the room's dimensions. So thirds, fifths, sevenths of the room's length, width, and height. Again, to minimize the chance that you will be sitting in a place of cancellation or reinforcement.
So if you put your TV right in the middle, you actually don't want to sit right in front of that TV. You might want to slide it over a little bit.
Correct.
Oh, interesting.
It's absolutely correct.
Well, so I'm going to try to draw a diagram for this and put it on the show notes, but I don't have much hope. Is there anywhere that we could go on the web? I mean, you would think that somebody would have a page that would, like, do this for you automatically.
You would think so, and I am actually working on trying to get a spreadsheet that would let you calculate these sorts of things. I don't have it yet, but when I do, I'll let you know, and you can put it in your show notes.
I would love to. Scott Wilkinson is a editor of video writing. No, that doesn't work either.
It doesn't quite work either.
He's a video editor. We'll just leave it at that. At the Perfect Vision Magazine, it's online free, of course, on newsstands as well, but online free at avguide.com. Next week, we're going to talk about screen size and resolution and how big a screen you need for how big a room and vice versa, how far away you should be sitting. That's going to be very interesting. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure, always.
Size really does matter. That's going to be the bottom line of that one, I think. We talked a little bit about it off the air, and you might be surprised at how big a screen you need. That's the bad news. All right, let's take a break. I do want to come back and talk more tech with you. Brian is going to Europe. He's looking for a good high-def camcorder with a hard drive. Janet wants a laptop for her daughter for college. And more 8888 Ask Leo. I am. From the Tech Guy Labs, Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8080, Ask Leo. What did I say? 8888, Ask Leo. All that math with Scott just has messed my brain up. 888-827-5536, that's the phone number. Brian is on the line from Malibu, listening on the great KFI in Los Angeles. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
Very well, how are you?
We're great. We're getting ready to go on a trip to London for Easter.
How fun.
And we're wanting to get a high-def camcorder to take along. You know, everybody's got these high-def TVs and things, and all you get is the regular old camcorders, and we thought we'd get a high-def camcorder. We need some advice about what to look at and what kind we might get and where to go.
What's your budget?
What's that?
What's your budget?
Probably about $1,000 to $1,500.
All right, I'm going to recommend that just came out the brand new Canon HV20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw that one. We saw that available April 2007.
Yeah, I mean it today. It's like it's coming out now.
Okay.
But if you can get it before you leave, that is a really interesting camcorder for a couple of reasons. One is it does a 24p. Video is 30 frames a second. Movies are 24 frames a second. And shooting in 24 frames gives it a much more movie-like quality. It's really neat. It really looks good. And also, there's advantages in terms of compression as well. It's a high-def 1080p. It is also capable of outputting to the HDMI jack. Now, that's kind of interesting because most of the time when you use a camcorder, it's compressing the video, then putting it on the tape.
Right.
And that compression loses some quality.
Right.
But these newer camcorders, which have HDMI out, you can, you know, the idea for that is that you would plug it into your TV and then you could watch yourself on TV, I guess. But it turns out you can also pump that HDMI into a hard drive or other devices and get uncompressed video or relatively uncompressed video right off the sensor. which is giving you 422 very high quality video, much better quality than you'd get off the tape. That's for so that's why a lot of people are very interested in this camera. It is, for $1,000, a remarkable deal.
Okay, yeah, we are actually on our way into one of your sponsors, Bel Air Cameras.
Oh, they're great. Yep, they have the HD20. Yeah. Well, they're advertising it. That's a good question. They are advertising it. I hope they have it. If not, they'll certainly tell you when they're going to have it. I know it started shipping from Amazon on Friday, I believe.
Okay.
So I think they may well have it in stock. If they don't, they'll have it this week. They'll have it before you go, I think.
Okay. All right.
That's the one I'm thinking right now is the high def camcorder. Now it's a single chip, but you're right. Not going to get a three chip high def camcorder in that price range.
All right.
So that's
I think that'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh, you're gonna love it, and I want you to call me back when you get back and let me know how it worked out for you.
Oh, sure will.
Will you? That's great. Thank you,
yeah,
Brian.
Sure
have a great trip.
Okay. Thanks
I'm
a lot.
I'm jealous. Yeah. There's a lot to be said. I mean, this is the thing about the HV20 as opposed to the HV10, which is the first edition, and by the way, very, very popular high-def camcorder. We're seeing now second-generation HD camcorders, consumer-grade, that is. And so we're seeing some interesting improvements, like this HDMI out, like this 24P. That's amazing. For a $1,000 camcorder, that's an amazing deal. Should you be shooting high-def now? That's an interesting question. If you don't have an HD TV and nobody you know does, and you're going to be recording it to DVD, probably not. A DVD is not high def. But if you're thinking about the future, remember when Super 8 was the format of the future, right? And then 16 millimeter, and then all of a sudden VHS. I think it's probably a good idea to think in terms of, look, the future is high def. There's no question. In fact, once you start watching high-def television and high-def movies, it's hard to watch standard definition. You can see how blurry it is. So I think even if now you don't have a high-def playback device, you're shooting these videos not so you can watch them tomorrow. You're shooting them so you'll be watching them 10 years from now. And I think, frankly, high-def will be kind of the minimum. In 10 years, nobody will want to watch anything less. Those standard definition movies would be like Super 8 movies. I'd love to hear from somebody who has other high-def camcorder recommendations, by the way. Sony makes a very good one. There are a lot of different choices, but my local experts are raving about the HV20. Janet Campbell, California. Janet, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. How are you, Janet?
I need help.
All right, I'll help you.
I am so confused about laptops. I want to buy one for my daughter. We're going to be three college students here.
Oh, boy.
And I've looked at a Dell, the E1505. Mm-hmm. I like their accidental damage policy.
Yep.
When I was telling her about it, she goes, oh, that sounds good.
Yep, she will damage it.
She will.
You know this. You have other college kids. You know.
Exactly.
Yep.
So I know that it'll get dropped, and I just want to make sure that I'm getting the best thing, and I don't have a lot of money to spend, but I don't want it to
I like the 1505. I think they're, because they're Core 2, you're getting a good, fast processor. They're very affordable, and Dell is really pushing now this robust, bulletproof laptop. I think if for in your price range, that is a very, very good choice.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, then I feel better.
Yeah, I like, I mean, that's, you're looking around, it's under 1,000, right?
Well, with everything that I've got, the Intel Core 2 Duo processor, and I want to get her 2 gigabytes of
good.
RAM.
You bet.
And 120 gigabyte hard drive, the double layer DVD plus drive.
I'm not sure you need to buy a DVD burner. That might be one place you could save. Is she going to be making DVDs?
Who knows? I'd like to have...
She'd be watching them.
So she can back up her data.
Yeah,
onto
but
she, them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's all right. It's probably not that much more expensive.
I can
nowadays.
Maybe cut down there, but the total that they have, including the 4-year warranty that they gave me, is $1,578.
Oh, man, that's amazing. No, it's a very nice laptop. The only negative, maybe it's a little heavy. You know, I mean, it's not a super lightweight. It's about 7 pounds.
Right. They also recommended the I think the 1405, which is the same thing but a pound lighter.
Yeah, I think in a way you don't want it to be too light. You don't want her carrying it everywhere she goes, right? Because that's how it gets damaged and lost. I think you're a nice mom, and I think you got the right choice. Leo Laporte, I am the tech guy. Stay right here. More calls to come. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. So glad you're here at the Tech Guy Labs.
Look around you. Don't touch anything. Some of these pieces of equipment are not fully grounded and could cause electrical shock.
Heck, this show could cause electrical shock, if not sticker shock. It could be expensive listening to this show, all the things you want to go out and run out and buy. 8888-ASK-LEO, but I have to say, that's the phone number, but I have to say, I can also save you money often. Because while I certainly talk about cool new things you may want to buy, I'm also quick to point out when something is overpriced or maybe isn't necessary. In fact, I really strongly believe that a lot of us should just stick with our Windows 98 machines, if only Microsoft would continue to support them with security updates. If it's still working, why should you have to trade it in? It's not like, you know, it's a car that's worn out. Computers don't wear out. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number, 888-827-5536. Chat room is at irc.dslextreme.com, and the website is at techguylabs.com. And don't worry, there's nothing on the website that could shock you. Well, I don't think so. Somebody snuck in there. Coming up in just a little bit, the gadget guru is going to try to get you to spend more money. Ron Rosberg. Also, Paul Thurrott, our Windows expert, has a great Windows tip for you. So you stick around. But I want to get right back to the phones. We've got so many great callers. And I love to talk to them all, like John, who's listening in San Jose on the great KGO. Hello, John.
Hi, Leo.
How are you? I hear you great. Thanks for joining us.
I saw you at the Mac Break Weekly in San Francisco. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did that at the Apple Store, right? Or no. We did it at the 21st Amendment.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That was a bit of a crowd. You managed to jam in there, huh?
Yeah.
Oh,
being
man.
Sumo size geek, it's really hard to squeeze into those places. Okay. My question is, I just got Windows Vista on my new notebook.
Yes, sir.
Compact notebook. And when I tried to listen to, like, say, online radio stations like KFI or which is...
Do you mean the internet streams you're talking about?
In the stream,
yeah,
my whole home network just goes down, and I have
to
unplug my Linksys router and plug it back in, and it just baffles me.
Does the same thing happen when you do long downloads, big downloads?
No, I can download Linux distros, your podcast, and Flash media, like YouTube works just fine.
Okay, I was thinking maybe that... it was overheating a little bit with kind of continuous network activity. If there's a card that is fragile, you know, on the very edge of its operating parameters, and just a little extra traffic could break it down. But, you know, listening to a stream is really not much different than listening to or making a big download. In fact, it's pretty much the same thing. You're just downloading the audio and playing it back as you download it.
Yeah.
So if a big download doesn't do the same thing, then we know now it's not overheating or a problem with the... And by the way, that can happen. I have a machine where it's fine until you start doing big transfers, and then all of a sudden it just the network card dies. Now I'm starting to think it's might have something to do with the router. It's a Linksys?
Yes. It's a wireless B, so it's kind of old-fashioned.
And it's wireless.
Yeah.
You say you reset the router. Have you tried doing a release and renew from Windows?
Yeah, I tried that.
And that did not fix it?
No.
Okay. So now we know it's the router. It's not a Windows driver. It's not a Windows issue. It's a router issue. And I have to say, the reason I asked if it was a Linksys is I've heard these problems before with Linksys and Netgear also, where sometimes just a lot of traffic, they'll collapse.
Okay.
So the best advice I can give you at this point is to update the firmware. You probably already did. You already do that?
Yes.
Yeah. You've got the latest firmware from Linksys. That's the software that's running in the router.
Yeah.
And often that'll fix little problems like this. I have to think it's just the router is crashing for some reason. Remember, it's just a computer. It's a dumb computer, but it's a computer, and it has to hand off that traffic. It sees that traffic coming in, and it has to hand it off to the right computer. And it's just somewhere in the software, it's probably got a buffer overflow or a memory leak, and boom, it's crashing.
Yeah, I was thinking of getting the new wireless N.
That's what I would think about doing. And by the way, even if you get If you get the wireless and the new and I recommend the Belkin. Linksys makes a good one, but I think the Belkin is the best. If you get that draft N router, you do not have to get all new N cards to take advantage of it. If you want the full speed, you'll need an N card. But
I just get the range because I also my apartment building I share internet access with other people, so.
I think it's the router, and you've already upgraded the firmware, which is about the only thing you can do to the router. You might.
Yeah.
Did you have to do some port forwarding for that to work?
No.
No, it just worked automatically?
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds like you've got universal plug and play turned on then.
Oh, no, I turned that off.
Oh, good man, John. You've been paying attention.
Plug and play.
Yeah. Not just on the computer, though. There's also a setting on the router.
Yeah, I look at that every day. Make sure it's
I think it's a time stable. For a new router. I hear about this problem frequently, unfortunately, and I think it's the routers getting knocked out. It's funny, especially this happens with wireless routers of all makes and all stripes, and I've had the same problem from my neighbors. You said you're in an apartment building. It might be even the neighbors. Because unfortunately, this is unregulated spectrum. The routers operate at this unregulated 2.4 gigahertz range, and frankly can cause problems. If you get an N router, one of the things you can do with the N router is say, don't use 2.4 gigahertz, use 5 gigahertz, which is also unregulated but much less crowded, and you may find it more reliable. My neighbors knock me off because they have one of these some of these routers that they sell increase their own speed at the cost of your speed. They use up all the channels and they'll just knock you off. You might try another channel. You might try moving both the router or the router and your machine. See if that helps. There is an update, and we talked about this on Security Now, the security podcast I do with Steve Gibson. There is an update to Windows if you're using XP. Since you said it's a new machine, it sounds like it's Vista, right? So this wouldn't be necessary for you, but for XP users, there is a unpublished, unannounced update to Zero Config, wireless Zero Config, that fixes a lot of problems you can get from Microsoft's page. I'll give you a link to that. They didn't push it out through Windows Update, weirdly enough. They just kind of put it out and didn't tell anybody. But apparently that fixes a lot of problems. Wireless is a black art, and sometimes you just have problems with it. Thanks for the call, John. Julian in Los Angeles. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Julian.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm happy about something that I heard you talk about earlier in the show.
And what was that, pray tell?
When you were talking about the barcode reading software that could be installed in cell phones.
Oh, you like that idea?
Oh, absolutely. I am visually impaired, and I have a Nokia Symbian phone that runs talking software, so the whole phone is accessible to me. And any programs that I run on it are accessible to me. And currently, if you want to buy a standalone barcode reading device that does what some of you are talking about, you're talking about spending $1,200-$1,300. So the thought about getting something that I can just install on my phone.
Wouldn't that be great? And I presume it could talk to you. I mean, the phone has that kind of capability.
Yeah, because the phone, it has screen reading software. So if I'm assuming...
Oh, interesting.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. When it gives the information about the barcode, is that given in text, like plain text?
No. Well, the solutions that they talked about in the Times, no. What it really would do is you take a picture of this barcode. The software that's in the phone would note that the picture wasn't a standard picture, but actually a picture of a barcode, would interpret the barcode. And in most cases, I think what it was doing is pulling up a link from the internet or getting data from the internet. Now, that doesn't mean you'd have to do it that way. It perfectly possible to get software that instead of doing that would interpret, would say out loud, http://www.
Exactly.
Presumably you could do that, but it would be specialized software. You're using screen reader software for a cell phone.
Yes. There's two products out there. The one is called Tox, made by a company called Nuance, and the other one is called MobileSpeak, made by a company called Code Factory.
Wow. And is it specifically for blind people, or is it just general? Because Nuance makes all sorts of speech recognition stuff.
Yeah. No, this is, I mean, well, it's targeted toward the blind, but it really, there's no reason why another person couldn't use it. It speaks everything. It speaks the menus. It even speaks the camera functions in the phone. things that I never thought I would want to use in a cell phone, I now have access to and
use
regularly.
Isn't that great? And it works on any phone that supports Java, or?
No, it's a Symbian phone.
Symbian, okay.
Yeah, so
very interesting.
Phone. There's also something else that I use that's free that I think is really cool. It's free GPS software.
Wow.
And combined with a Bluetooth receiver, this software that I got for free, it's open source, I can now know where I am anywhere.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah,
wow.
It's great.
I need that. I get lost all the time.
If you want, I can give you the website.
Yeah, please do. What is it?
It's www.loadstone-gps.com.
L-O-D-E?
Yeah, L-O-A-D.
L-O-A-D-O-N-E. Okay, L-O-A-D.
-gps.com.
And interesting.
It's a project. It's an open source. Anybody can participate in it. And what makes it great is that as people store their own wave points, they share it in a database, and we all have access to it.
Oh, that's great. So it enriches it all the time.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful.
There's a Starbucks here. Run.
Yeah, you can add that. I mean,
thank you. Hey, I got to run, Julian, but thank you. I appreciate the call. I want to talk a little bit about what's happening with cell phones in a bit. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, the tech guy. This is kind of like a MIDI version of the Peter Gunn theme. Don't you think a tech guy show, all the songs should just be MIDI? Like the Pac-Man theme. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Gadget guru Ron Rosberg coming up to help us spend our money. He's good at that. Meanwhile, from Morristown, New Jersey. Wait a minute, let me push the right button here. It's Dennis. Hello, Dennis. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Dennis, are you there? Did I push the right button? I don't hear you, Dennis. Hello, Dennis. All right, I'm going to put you back on hold and see if I can raise you in a second. Maybe they can help you in the studio. Meanwhile, is he there? I'll go to Steve from San Jose. Hello, Steve. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. I've listened to you for years and learned so much, and now I really need your help.
I'm really glad to be back on in San Francisco. You know,
I'm glad you're back, too.
Yeah, it's so fun. I worked on the great KGO for years, and KSFO before that, and KNBR before that, and so it's fun to be back on in the city.
Even on the screensavers, you were great.
Ah, yes! The old screensavers. It's funny. People still talk about that. That show's been off the air now for years, and people still talk about that.
Well, it was good.
Yeah, now I know how Robert Vaughn or Ilya David McCollum fell. So what can I do for you?
About 2 years ago, I built a computer with a SATA drive.
Okay. Wow, 2 years ago. You were state of the art.
Yeah, I was. And all of a sudden, this week, it quit. Mm. It won't see the drive. Now, there's a slave drive on it. It can see, but it's not bootable on the slave.
Yeah.
And if I take the SATA drive out of that computer and put in another computer I have that also has a SATA drive, that computer will see it.
Oh, interesting. So the drive's not bad.
The drive's not bad, and the cable's not bad because I use the cable.
Use
on
the same
computer.
Cable.
But
yeah.
When it boots to the memory test, you know, the first screen, it doesn't see it. Then it goes to a SATA host controller screen, and it does see it. But then that's it. That's as far as it goes.
Interesting. Is the second drive also SATA, or is it an IDE drive?
The second drive is an IDE.
So the only drive on the SATA chain in that computer is that drive that's not working.
Well, that it won't see, right?
It won't see. So one has to suspect you've done all the right things. This is the way you troubleshoot, isn't it? You eliminate possibilities. So you thought, well, could it be the drive? Could it be the cable? And you've eliminated that. You know it will both work. Unless it's some sort of interaction between the drive and that machine.
I was wondering that. I went into the BIOS and try to see if there's any. The BIOS won't see it either.
See, now, remember that on that older machine, you had to tell it to boot from the SATA chain. Otherwise, by default, it boots from the IDE chain. So.
Correct. And I did that, too.
You make sure that and that could be one thing that could happen. You know, 2 years is about the right length of time, maybe, for a battery, the battery backup and the CMOS to fail. And it could be that its settings got messed up. So one thing you might want to try
You know, there's the ESCD data, the Enhanced System Configuration data. It's a little bit of memory that's dedicated to how your system's configured. And if it got zapped by a stray electrical lightning bolt passing through your machine, or if the battery flaked out, the ESCD data might be out of date. Have you updated your ESCD data?
I've never even heard of ESCD.
You never heard of that. I don't know what it is, Mr. Laporte. What the heck are you talking about? So if you go back in the BIOS, it'll sometimes say ESCD. Sometimes it'll say system configuration. But look in there, and there is a setting in the BIOS to reset the ESCD. So I'd go back into your BIOS. This is just, we're trying to figure out if it's, what we don't want it to be is the SATA chipset, which it could be. So, but this is to make sure that it's, because that's on the motherboard probably. And so that's a replacement of the motherboard is the only way to fix that. So this is to try all this again. We're eliminating you always do the easy stuff first, and when you eliminate all the easy possibilities, you are left, unfortunately, with the.
Now when I go to the BIOS
ones.
Setup and it doesn't see the drive there either, isn't?
Well, you still want to tell. So what you're going to do is you're going to tell, and the reason it doesn't see it, I'm hoping, is that the ESCD is out of date or wrong.
Okay.
So what you're going to do is you're going to still tell it boot from the SATA chain. And you're going to find that setting, and it's buried in there somewhere. It's different in every system, but you're going to find that setting that says update the system configuration or update the ESCD. And what it does, it actually goes out. See, it's making an assumption that there's no SATA drive based on the ESCD data. So you have to tell it, no, no, please, trust me, go out and check. And it'll go, and then it checks, because we know we can see it because your SATA configuration can see it.
Yes.
So what we're trying to do is convince the CMOS to look again. And if it finds it, it'll then add it to the ESCD.
And just resetting the CMOS won't do that?
Not necessarily. You really want to look for that ESCD setting, because it's not part of the it is technically part of the CMOS, but it's a separate area of memory.
I will look for it.
Yeah, I think that's at least let's hope that's it. Cuz if it's not, then it probably is the fact that the SATA chip died. Early SATA, you never know. It may be that you updated a driver and accidentally crashed the SATA driver. I don't know. Could be a lot of things. Gadget guru Ron Rosberg's coming up in just a little bit to help us spend our money. I was going to talk about cell phones some more. I'll still do that. And we also have our Windows guru, Paul Thurrott, with a quick Windows tip. Is a Vista tip. We've been doing Vista tips with Paul. There's a lot of new stuff. There's a lot of new stuff in Vista. And he has some great, you know, he digs around and he finds these neat little things. So we'll be doing that all in this hour. I've got too much stuff, too much good stuff for you. I've put together your calls to 8888 Ask Leo. We're going to talk to Eric, who's listening on satellite in Texas. He's got a problem with DVD playback on his computer. And Dennis in New Jersey, we're going to try to get you back on too. He wants to buy a MacBook. Refurbished or not? What do you think? More of your calls to come. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. And we are talking high tech today from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California. As always, at this time, we'd like to check in with our gadget guru, Ron Rosberg, the man who's been covering this field for longer than anybody else. Started going to CES at number one, the first consumer electronics show back in 1932. And he's
No. It's before that. Noah asked me to come on aboard. But he was trying to find the female side.
He was doing those electric dog collars, and he couldn't find them. And, you know, the giraffe, it was too hard on the throat.
Right.
So, Ron,
yes, sir.
We went to a ball game on Friday. Went to see the Giants play. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thank you. And
right,
you shined a very bright light in my eyes. And
I did not need to do it with lights, because this thing is designed, what this is called Bright Strike, Leo, but it's a miniature flashlight, and they come in several different sizes, and I think you'll put the link up to show people where to
you
go.
Bet.
And,
yep.
By the way, it's BRITESTRIKE. But this is designed by a police officer, four police officers. They have two models. They have what they call the Blue Dot, which is their tactical flashlight. Again, miniaturized. And then also for people who want to take the self-defense, a lot of police departments offer citizens a self-defense course.
Well, you wouldn't want to hit anybody with this thing. It's only about the size of a Zippo lighter.
But also, Leo, it's so bright that you could momentarily disable someone by shining the light in their eyes.
Ah. Okay.
You don't want to.
And, you know, the CHP does that all the time, the Highway Patrol. They pull you over, just to make sure they blind you with that light so they can check you out before you get a chance to do anything bad.
And most flashlights, Leo, are about 30 lumens. This little flashlight that's about like 3 inches long is 80 to 90 lumens. Wow.
It was really bright. I you didn't shine it in my eyes, but you gave it to me and said, what do you think this is? I pushed the button and it was, wow, whoa. It's very bright. It hurts your eyes. It's so bright. And yet it's an LED, right?
Yeah, one LED, Leo, will last 100,000 hours. And it uses a 1-2-3 a little cell, and you can get up to
it's one of those one of those lithium watch batteries.
Yeah, right. Well, it's the bigger. It almost looks like a miniature AAA, basically, right. A little bit wider.
Right.
And you can get 4 hours or 2 hours, depending on a lot of these. Depending if you get the model, they have low setting and high setting. So some will go up to 35 hours if you put the lower setting on. So I just want to tell people that this is a solution if you're looking for something you can carry in your pocket, well made, waterproof, by the way, also, well designed, well built, and everything else. Just the engineering on it is super. You want to take a look at BrightStrike. They run anywhere from about $80. On up to a couple $100. They're going to have rechargeable ones available too, I think, later this year.
So they're expensive. This is not a cheap. This is kind of on the order of a mag light.
Well, we're talking about spending money today, Leo. So I thought, well, you know, you can go buy a flashlight for $2. I want people to see where if you spend $80 to $100, $150. But if you wanted to give, let's say, a nice Father's Day gift that it doesn't have, or your uncle, your grandfather, your father, whatever, doesn't have, trust me, they probably don't have this. It's something to take a look at. It's something that you'll keep rest of your life.
You could keep it in your pocket. It's pretty small.
Absolutely. It comes with a ballistic holster, so you can keep it on your belt. It also has a clip, so you can just clip it. I had mine clipped onto my belt the other day. So it's just something that I want to carry around. It's just a nice piece of equipment.
I think this would be a great gift for any woman in your life who has to walk around at night.
Absolutely.
I'm going to give one to my daughter so that she has a bright light she could use that would really be a useful thing to have.
Absolutely. It is. It's a really nice item. Leo, another thing, talking about solutions, in fact, I had to use this morning. I was taking some pictures off my camera, and I pulled out my SD card. And as you know, SD is probably the most used memory storage card there is, more so than even CF. But there's a lot of SD stuff out there, cameras and things like that. What is super about this is made by SanDisk. SanDisk is the only one I know who actually makes this. But it's an SD card. Imagine this. Take the SD card in your hand, that little small card, and bend it in half, Leo. And what it does, it actually goes into any USB port.
So now, you don't need a USB reader.
Absolutely not. You don't need just if you have almost all computers, unless we go back, 10 years ago or whatever, have USBs on them. And so what this is, you be careful. You don't bust it in half, but you just bend it and it snaps up and you pop it into a USB port and that's it. It's dynamite. So if you're at a relative's house, you have a bunch of pictures or whatever you want to share and you don't they don't have a reader. A lot of computer issues, you know, are putting readers. In fact, someone called me the other day and was asking me about something. I said, well, you just bought a new computer. Don't you have a reader on? He said, no. And I said, well, you better take a look. And he looked and said, oh, yeah, I do.
You forget that they have them.
Yeah, right. And so this is called the SanDisk it's the SD double capacity. It's Ultra 2 SD Plus. Ultra 2 SD Plus. The plus means it actually snaps in half, basically. Again, it doesn't come apart, gives you...
They showed me this at CES 2 years ago, they've done a lousy job of telling people it exists.
You know, if you go over to SanDisk.com and you take a look at the Plus, they don't even show, to my knowledge, I was on it this morning, they don't even show you a picture of what this thing does. And the, you know, so I, that's what I want to bring it up to about someone's attention out there. It's a little bit more expensive, but the use on it is phenomenal. That especially in cameras, so you could just pop it into your computer without carrying a reader and stuff like that. The prices on it. Let me give you some ideas. Amazon sells a 2 gig card for like $48. Okay, 1 gig card $37. Again, shop around for the best prices on it. But it's called the SanDisk Ultra 2 SD Plus, and it is just a really neat thing. I also, Leo, if they go over to DP Review, and it has a picture of actually showing you. Also, I happen to go into eBay, and I put in the Ultra 2 SD Plus, and it's got the best picture of anybody over
there.
We'll
steal that picture and put it on our website. Because it's hard to understand just describing it, what it does.
Absolutely. You know, because like people think you're breaking it. You don't, you know, the engineering on it. I talked about this at, as I say, it was 2 years ago at CES. That we actually, in fact, actually, I think it was 3 years ago that had a sample of it, but SanDisk has not done a great job on it. So we're going to try and help SanDisk.
You know why? They sell card readers. And, right. And they don't want to, I'm sure that the division that sells the card readers keeps telling the division that sells the memory, don't tell anybody.
Yeah, let's not even put a picture up and show people how it works.
Can you believe that? I mean, they describe it on the website, in the description. But you never see a picture of it. That's crazy.
In fact, I did mention to him, because I did this on another one of my programs a while back, and I mentioned to him, and I don't think they listened to me. And I own a few shares of SanDisk. I better go call them up and tell them.
I don't think for 4 shares they're going to pay any attention.
Right, right. plus my PR friend has just retired after so many years.
Oh,
so.
All right.
Anyway, happy retirement, Bob.
Great to talk to you. Happy April Fool's Day. Are you playing any pranks on anybody?
No. You know, I'm very, you know why. Anyway.
He's a serious boy today.
Yeah, right.
Well, we wish you all the best.
Happy April Fool's Day to everybody out there, and we'll talk to you next week. I'll have to come up with something exciting next week.
We'll talk to you again. Same time, same
channel. We'll have all the audience go and take second mortgages on their house, because I'll talk about something even more expensive.
Would you please? Because I love it. I love spending their money. Thank you, Ron Rosberg.
Bye.
The gadget guru, Ron Rosberg. Always good to talk to him. And that, you know, it's, I saw that SanDisk thing. Yeah, I guess it must have been 3 years ago now, because I didn't go to the last two CESs, and I forgot about it even. But it's a great little idea. I'm glad they're still doing it. Now let's see if we can get Dennis on the line from Morristown, New Jersey. Hello, Dennis.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
There you are. I'm great. How are you today?
Oh, now that I pushed my mute button again, I'm okay.
You know, that happens, but more often than you might think.
I do a lot of Skype because I heard a bit from you, and I got in on that $15 deal.
Isn't that a great deal? Yeah.
Oh, my God. And I have the Logitech headset, but the mute button is right in the middle of the cord, and it's huge. And
my buddy bought Paul Theroux. Now it explains it, because my buddy Paul Theroux, who does the Windows Weekly podcast with me, sits on it all the time, and he'll just go quiet all of a sudden. And now I understand why. It's an easy button to sit on, it sounds like.
It's bigger than a quarter. It's huge.
What can I do for you today, Dennis?
Well, Leo, I'm a photographer, and I have really labored over whether to make the switch over to Apple. And looking at the MacBook Pro, a couple of my associates got them recently, and I'm just in love with the way the thing is built.
Oh, yeah.
And
if you're a photographer, I think you got to go with a Mac.
Yeah. But because I'm a photographer, I spend a lot of money on my photo gear, you know, the Nikon D200, 28-72-8, all that stuff.
Right.
And I was hoping to ask you, is it making any sense, or is it being foolish to look at the Apple refurb when you're looking for something like that?
Now, that's a great question. It doesn't just apply to Apple. It applies to Dell and a lot of other companies that have on their site refurbished computers. If you're buying the same model they're selling today, in other words, it's not an old model, but if you're buying the same model they're selling today, I think it's a very good idea. Here's why. Until a few years ago, companies were able to sell opened product as new. If you ordered a laptop from Apple or Dell and you didn't want it, or you had buyer's remorse, or your wife caught you, you sealed it back up and you sent it back to them, they could not sell that as new. They used to do that, but now they can't. They have to sell it as used. So a lot of these so-called refurbs really are never used or very lightly used. As long as there are current models, they're not, you know, out of stock old models, and as long as they offer you the same exact warranty they do on new, very often refurb is a good idea. That thing has been burned in, it's been tested more than the one that you're going to get new, and the discounts can be significant.
Right. Well, instead of $2,500 for the current, you know, the current top model with 2 gigs of RAM, it's you save $500. It's $19.99, yeah. And it's got the same 1 year Apple warranty.
Yeah.
And I can even get AppleCare.
I'd probably get AppleCare, although that would then eat up some of that cost that
yeah,
you just saved.
Yeah.
I do usually get AppleCare on the laptops because you know, laptops tend to go wrong faster because you're shaking them around and stuff. I have no problem with Apple and Dell refurbs. Now, I'd be very careful with other companies' refurbs. But I have purchased both Apple and Dell refurbs, and I think that they're basically new machines that they were opened, and they can't sell as new. And I think that that's a real opportunity for a consumer.
Well, I got something from Apple before. I have an iPod Video, and by the way, I look at to prepare for switching to Apple. I look at MacBreak. Your video podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And I use my video 60 gig iPod, but I just got a 1 gig current generation shuffle. Instead of $79, it was $49.
And I'll tell you, solid state, there's no reason not to get refurb. There's nothing that can go wrong with that. I mean, that is good, isn't it? No, go for it, Dennis. And good luck with the switch. I think you're going to be glad you did. Coming up, a Vista tip from Paul Theron. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy from the Tech Guy Labs. We got the beakers on, the burners bubbling. Actually, we don't need burners anymore. We've got Apple TV, and it really makes a fine little heating pad for all of our experiments here in the lab, not to mention keeping our cups of coffee warm. Paul Theron is here, as he is every week, to talk a little bit about Windows Vista. Give us tips. Paul is the news editor for Windows IT Pro and runs a great site if you're interested in Windows, particularly Windows Vista, called the Super Site for Windows. It's at winsupersite.com. Hello, Paul.
Hello, sir.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Another Windows tip. You know, I have to say I really enjoy these because Vista is so new.
Yeah.
And it's taken me a while to kind of understand all the new things in it. And it's really helpful to get little tours here and there. So I think we should just keep doing this.
This is the cool thing about Vista. This, you know, people have complained that there isn't this one big thing, but there are all these awesome little things. And, you know, taken individually, they're not necessarily a gotta-have-it feature, but, you know, add them all together, it's something pretty neat.
Fun to explore, I have to say.
Yeah.
There's a lot of little surprises. So give us a little-known Windows Vista tip.
Okay. So most people probably understand that they could go into Windows Photo Gallery, which is Microsoft's, you know, photo management and editing application, and they could trigger a slideshow from there. But actually, there's an even better slideshow feature built into the Windows shell in Windows Vista. It's kind of a hidden feature. You have to kind of know to look for it, but it's a neat little feature. So what you need to do is just go to a folder that has pictures in it, and you'll see a slideshow button appears up on the toolbar of that window. And you click that, and a full screen slideshow will start. And I'm waiting for this to happen. This folder has a lot of pictures here. But what's neat about this is you've got this toolbar, sort of a little navigational bar at the bottom. And it allows you to step through the slideshow. You can pause it and so forth. You can configure various settings. But what's really neat is there's a themes button. And when you click on that, you get a bunch of different themes, some of which are quite attractive. So,
Neat. So it's not just a plain old slideshow anymore.
Yeah, you can all different styles. So the travel style makes it look like, you know, you've got these you know, passport stamps in the background, and all of the different themes change the look and feel of the slideshow, and some of them are really neat.
All the Mac people are saying, "Well, that sounds like iPhoto," but this is built into the operating system. It's not a standalone
application. It's right. It's right in the shell. So even if you choose to, you know, use Picasa or some other application to manage your photos,
which I do, I love Picasa.
Yeah, you can still access this this excellent feature without having to run Windows Photo Gallery.
Walk me through it again. So you open any folder with pictures in it.
Any folder with pictures.
My pictures would be a good place to start.
Yeah. Yep. And up in the toolbar, that green toolbar, you'll see an option called slideshow. You click on that, and this thing will come up full screen. It's got sort of a navigational deal at the bottom that will disappear if you stop moving the mouse. And you can click the theme button, and you've got a pop-up there. You can choose the classic style, fading, panning, and zooming, black and white, sepia, and so forth. But then there are different styles as well.
My theme button collage is not showing up. I wonder, now I'm not, I don't get arrow, so I wonder if this is arrow.
Oh, maybe this is an arrow feature. That could be.
Yeah, I bet it is, because I'm not
another,
getting
that. Another arrow advantage.
I'm running it in Parallels on a Mac, and so I don't get when I don't get
so that. Do you not, you just don't see themes, but you see the regular
I don't
stuff.
Even see the controller. I can do is just watch a picture show go. And that makes sense, because the controller's using transparency, I bet. And
yes.
Yeah. There's all these things that I can't do. But that's all right. I still get a slideshow. Just no theming.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Paul Theroux, for once again making me feel just a little bit more inadequate. Paul, no, I'm just kidding you. Paul is actually a really great asset. We talk every week on this show, but we also do a podcast together, if you're really into Windows, that is available via twit.tv. It's called Windows Weekly, and we talk for around an hour about Vista stuff and news and so forth, and often have interviews with Microsoft folks. It's a lot of fun. TWIT.TV. Thanks, Paul. We'll talk again next week.
Thank you.
Let's go to line four here. Eric, listening on XM Radio. Channel 152 in Texas. Hello, Eric.
Hi, Leo. My question is this. I recently bought a Dell XPS M2010, which is the really big one that they have.
Yep.
And it's supposed to have really good sound.
20-inch screen. Reason. Beautiful.
Yeah. It's a really nice computer.
I saw somebody using that in the airport, and I thought, why has he got his desktop computer with him? It's huge.
Yeah, I get that quite a bit whenever I take it out, too.
You carry that thing around?
Yeah, I do. Well, I'm a truck driver, so.
Oh, yeah, so it's great. It's perfect for that.
Yeah.
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 Are you long haul?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you watch DVDs on it?
Yes. But when I do, like, whenever the movie actually starts to play, the volume drops way down.
Yeah.
And it does it when I do it, when I use external speakers or headphones also. But the menus on the DVD play
bonk,
a decent
bonk, bonk, chunk, bong. So what player are you using?
I've tried using Windows Media Player.
Is it low even in Windows Media? It's low even in Windows Media Player.
Yep, Media Player, the Dell Media Experience, and the interactual viewer that comes with some DVDs.
Right. Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, it is AC3 surround sound, and it is lower. It's got a broader dynamic range, and it's just lower. In fact, when you listen to AC3 in stereo speakers, often people complain, boy, it's not as loud. So that's one issue, and turning it up or will help. I would also, though, look in the advanced settings of your player. Some players do a better job, for instance, and that's why I asked you, Power DVD, you can turn on hardware acceleration, and it'll sound better. Some players in the advanced section, they actually have level settings that you could turn it up for the player only. But often people complain about this. In fact, if you Google low volume and DVD, you'll see this is a very common complaint. And really, some of it is just that's the nature of DVDs. But I would look and see in the hardware that you're using, or rather the player that you're using, if there is a way to turn it up inside the advanced settings of the player, or in some cases, turning on hardware acceleration for hardware decode and hardware video and audio acceleration. If you do that, sometimes that also makes a big difference. That's particularly, I think, on WinDVD. That's the CyberLink program. PowerDVD, I'm not sure if it has the problem. And you said, if it happens with everything you're using, then it's probably just, frankly, just the fact that it's surround sound. And on stereo, it's just lower. We're going to take a break. I am Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time. The Tech Guy. from the Tech Guy Labs, situated high atop Silicon Valley, the northernmost point, beautiful Petaluma, California. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. And this is the show where we talk about technology every week, about how it works, how to buy it, how to, I like to say how to choose it, how to use it, how to abuse it, and then how to lose it when you're done. All of that. And technology doesn't just mean computers or the internet. It means cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and home theater, and we do all of that. All right, coming up, a new contributor to the show, about half an hour from now, Chris Marquardt, who is from Tübingen, Germany. He does one of the best podcasts on photography, digital photography, called Tips from the Top Floor. Chris will be joining us to give you some really basic photography tips that are very helpful. I know a lot of people are, because of the prevalence of digital cameras now, are starting to get into photography in a way that this never happened before. I think this is one of the best things about digital technology in general, is that it makes it so easy to create in new ways. And so there are people making their first films. There are people making their new music. Never did it before. I know I'm one of them. I love playing with GarageBand. I have no musical training, but it's just so much fun making your own songs. And photography, of course, is so much fun. So we'll be talking to him in just a little bit. He's going to join us to give us basic photography tips. It's kind of like a little mini class. So have you been following the saga of the Pirate Bay? Army matey, there's pirates. They really are pirates. It's a site in Sweden. Doesn't host any stolen stuff, but it still drives the movie industry crazy. It doesn't. There's no illegal films or music or anything on their site. But there are links to illegal music, film, and stuff on their site. Links to BitTorrent files. BitTorrent is the really amazing file sharing technology. Not good for piracy, by the way, because in general with BitTorrent, unless you're taking extra steps, you're completely visible when you're downloading these files. It's not hard to figure out who's offering them and who's downloading them. But the Pirate Bay has been harassed and chased by the Motion Picture Association. At one point, the U.S. government convinced the Swedish government to raid them. Swedish courts threw it out. And the Pirate Bay went right back up online. Now, get this. This must be an April Fool's joke, now that I look at it. They say, finally, a permanent solution for hosting of Pirate Bay, arr. Now, that's a combination of accents to a Swedish pirate, arr. Today, we announced we're moving some of our servers to the North Korean embassy in Stockholm. Now I'm realizing I fell for it. After lengthy discussions with the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, we have decided to start cooperating with them. This is the company that, and not as an April Fool's joke, tried to buy an island. It wasn't even an island. It was an old platform, gunnery platform out in the North Sea that declared itself a sovereign state 20 or 30 years ago. They were trying to buy that. SeaLink, it's called. They were trying to buy that for their hosting. I think they're actually pretty safe. The Swedish government doesn't seem to have much stomach for prosecuting them. And I'll tell you, I mean, I don't use BitTorrent to get movies. I frankly mostly buy them just because it's so much easier. And, I feel like I want to support the idea of selling movies online. I don't like the copy protection in them, but I want to encourage the movie companies and the television networks to continue to sell their stuff online. So I try to make a point of buying one every few weeks, just, you know, to say, hey, there's a market for this. But I do go to piratebay.org. I do go to their site because they're so funny. When they get cease and desist letters from, the Motion Picture Association and the Recording Industry of America, when they get these cease and desist letters, they publish them and they mock them. It's pretty funny. If you go to thepiratebay.org and you click legal threats, you can read all of them from Microsoft and DreamWorks, Electronic Arts, Sega, Apple, the White Stripes, the Warner Brothers Records. And they're just so mean. They just thumb their nose at them. They say, Ha-ha, you cannot get us. We're in Sweden, but it's okay. They also make, I think, the somewhat legitimate point that they don't actually store any of these files. They just tell people where to find them. I think in the U.S. courts, they might have a little bit of a problem there because it is illegal, according to U.S. copyright law, to encourage piracy. You don't actually have to participate in it. It's just illegal to encourage it. Which, frankly, puts me sometimes in the line of fire because, you know, I often will help people understand how to copy their DVDs, for instance, which I don't consider piracy. If you bought a DVD, even though it's copy protected, I think you should have the right to make an archival backup for it. What other news? I have to be very careful on April Fool's because I have to use every ounce of my critical thinking to figure out if it's an April Fool's joke or not. But according to Engadget, and I think this is true, Steve Jobs is going to be presenting a keynote at a media event in London for EMI. That's the company that publishes the Beatles music. And as you may know, the Beatles and the were suing Apple, saying you're in the music business with the same name and you're not allowed to be. And well, they've settled. They settled that a month or so ago. Apple gave them a packet of money. And the Beatles said, I think we'll put our music out on iTunes. And I'm waiting for that to happen, actually. At some point, that's supposed to happen. Anyway, so that should be interesting. What do you think Steve Jobs will be saying? He'll probably be announcing that the Beatles music is on iTunes, but maybe I've been lobbying for a special new iPod using the iPhone screen, the iPhone touch interface, and maybe a special Beatles, you know, Strawberry Fields Forever iPod. I'd like to see that. So I'm going to continue in my fantasy world and say maybe Steve will be announcing that. When is that event? I'm trying to find the details here. It doesn't say the date. I think it's this week. So we should know. We should know soon. This is, by the way, the 31st anniversary of the incorporation of Apple Computer. So happy birthday to Apple. 888-ASK-LEO is my phone number. 888-ASK-LEO. I'd love to hear from you. We can talk about anything having to do with tech, starting with John, who's on line one from... Where are you calling from, John?
Such as Georgia.
From beautiful Georgia.
That's right.
What can I do for you?
North Georgia Mountains.
Oh, is that gorgeous?
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful.
Beautiful area.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, John.
Your podcasts have so helped me out. The twits are a big, big help for me. And I do appreciate it.
People say, why do you call yourself a twit? It stands for This Week in Tech, and I'm proud to be a twit.
Well, you all have been a great big help for
Thanks,
me, and
John.
I appreciate it very much.
It's our pleasure.
And actually, part of your podcasts have been an inspiration for why I've done a podcast. I have a Christian
neat.
Podcast.
What's the address?
It's shulamitepodcast.com. S-H-U-L-A-M-I-T-E podcast.com. And I just found out that the interviewing style is a whole lot easier to listen to than the teaching style. So you have really been an inspiration for the format, let me tell you.
I tell people, we just completed a three-day podcast seminar in San Francisco this week, and I tell people it's hard to do a podcast all by yourself. And I encourage you, if you do a podcast, which is an internet radio show, have a guest. Conversations
Absolutely.
Are much easier. Yeah.
Well, it's so much easier to listen to. I mean, if you're listening to at church, you're hearing someone preach at you. It's, you know, your head goes off and you fly away and then come back and
right.
You don't know where you are.
And that's a trained professional, too. I mean, somebody who is good at monologizing, at speaking, you know, solo, that's hard to do. And I think that's one of the things ministers and priests and rabbis spend a lot of time learning. And a good one will know how to keep your interest. But it's very difficult. Much easier to have, as you say, much easier to listen to a conversation.
Absolutely. Well, I actually have a question about the podcast. I have, through my .Mac account, I've run it through iWeb, and that's where I started it, and I'm now going...
Looks beautiful, too, by the way. That does a very nice job.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking at the site.
I've ended up, you know, I got a video podcast up today and everything like that, but iTunes and iWeb, they don't give you any stats. And no, I can't get any information about it, how many subscribers, how many listeners, how many, can't get anything.
Nope.
So I thought about getting the FeedBurner account, but I cannot figure out for the life of me, nor can .Mac technical support or FeedBurner, how am I to do a redirect, you know, and so.
It's a tricky one. If you can put a raw link in, this is one of the reasons I discourage iWeb. iWeb is great when you're just starting out. I mean, look at this beautiful page you did with just a couple of clicks of the button. But it limits you, as do all these solutions. As you get more sophisticated, then you start wanting to do more than these built-in box solutions can do. I would, if you can change the link manually to anything you want, then you can go through PodTrack, PodTrac.com. It's free to sign up and use. They give you very good statistics, and it's a redirect. So you'll be going through, but you have to be able to change the link to link it through PodTrack. But that's what I use.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, they tell you, if you go to PodTrac.com, essentially you add a little bit to the beginning of the link so that their servers see it and then send it on to a .Mac where your podcast actually lives. It actually works very well, and the question is, will it work with iWeb? And I'm not sure, but I think it will. They do a great job. PodTrac.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, on Premier Radio Networks, almost said a radio station, on lots of radio stations all over the country. So glad you're listening. Also on podcast at twit.tv, and the website is techguylabs.com. You can download the episodes of the show from there as well, and also see our show notes. There's a link there to the chat room, and a whole lot more tips, tricks, ideas. We're still getting that redesign, by the way. It hasn't finished yet. But once the redesign of the website is done, there'll be lots more places for you to participate. Because I am a big believer in the fact that the web and the internet, it's all about conversation. It's not about one person talking, everybody else listening. It's like talk radio, where it's a conversation. And that's why I love talk radio. That's why I love the internet. I love podcasts. So we want to make more of a conversation on that webpage. And we will. We will. I promise. We always talk on the show about the revolution that's occurring in the media. Apple TV, we talked about it last week. Boy, that's revolutionary in the sense that now it's very easy for people to get video off of their computers and play it on their big screen TV. It's the convergence device that brings the computer and the entertainment center together. A number of other companies make similar products, of course. And there's going to be a new one sometime soon, I think, from Sling Media that should be very interesting. Here's another sign of convergence. Michael Eisner, the former Walt Disney CEO, formed a new studio, and his first production isn't going to be in movie theaters, isn't going to be on TV. It's going to be on MySpace. Starting today, Prom Queen. 80 episodes, 90 seconds each. Each episode appears on MySpace for 12 hours exclusively. And they're smart. They know they can't keep people from putting it on YouTube and Rever and everywhere else. So after the 12-hour period, it'll show up, I'm sure, other places, including a dedicated Prom Queen website. Very interesting. It's showing you now here Hollywood is moving in big time. They're saying, well, we see something going on here. Now, Eisner, is just a producer. He sees the writing on the wall and he wants to be a participant. He saw Lonely Girl 15 take off on YouTube. He hired the team of writers who do a web show called Sam Has Seven Friends. I haven't seen that, but I guess it's fairly popular. So they'll be doing Prom Queen on MySpace. Wow. That's kind of a revolution. Let's talk to Sarah, listening on the great KFI in Laguna Niguel. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Leo. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course. Thanks for holding on.
I'm a college student transferring to a Cal State and as a graphic design major, and I'm curious as what is the best laptop and desktop to buy without, like, breaking the bank.
What programs do you use right now?
Right now I'm using Photoshop, Illustrator, Dreamweaver.
The good news is, of course, that the new versions of those programs are coming out, CS3.
Yeah, I heard.
Yeah, and they run on Windows and Mac, so you have the option to choose. I have to say, most graphics designers I know use Macintosh, although there's technically, I don't think, any reason why you would have to use a Macintosh. You can, since those programs, all of the ones you just mentioned, are available on both sides, you know, you could go in either. In fact, until CS3, the fastest version of Photoshop ran on Windows. It was much faster than the Mac version of Photoshop.
I noticed that. I have a PC at home, so.
But they've solved that. I mean, if you're going to get a new Mac, you'll be getting CS3, and the Intel version of Photoshop is very, very fast. I haven't seen benchmarks yet comparing it to the Windows version, but I would guess it's as fast. And so really, it's more a question, in this case, of what you prefer and of what you're going to get support for. Now, at your new school, have you talked to anybody about what they use, what your classes will be using?
I have. I talked to the Illustrator teacher there, and he said, you know, whatever it is, whatever your personal preference is, really, because I'm thinking I'll need a laptop to take to class every day
right.
to do my work on.
Right.
So I was thinking of a MacBook or MacBook Pro, but then again, I don't know which one of those is the best one to get for the money.
Well, and that's an issue of budget. I mean, if you had no budget issue, the 17-inch MacBook Pro is the clear choice. It's fast. It's very powerful. It's also about $3,000. So it's a clear choice if you've got a lot of money. I happen to have a MacBook, bought a MacBook, which is the low end, and found it was a little slow for some of the things I wanted to do, chiefly for Keynote, which is their presentation program, and I was doing a lot of video in my presentations, and the MacBook's video subsystem wasn't fast enough. That wouldn't impact you necessarily, but it did make a difference. I would say, though, given the programs you're talking about, you probably want at least a Pro. Whether it's a 15 or a 17 is up to you. The 17 is slightly faster and, of course, has the bigger screen.
And also, I was thinking of building my own PC because the one I have now is pretty junky. I can't even run Photoshop at all, it seems like.
I think, you know... You want a desktop and a laptop.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I don't know if it's...
I wouldn't do that. Get a good laptop. Now that this justifies $3,000 for a Pro, a MacBook Pro, because it's a desktop. It's desktop power in a portable computer. So you don't need both. And frankly, I don't think you want both. You'd have to transfer stuff back and forth. It could be a real pain. Don't get both. Take the money that you would have for your desktop PC and your laptop and combine them, and that'll get you closer to the MacBook Pro range. $2,500 for the 15-inch, $2,800 for the 17-inch. Do get 2 gigs of RAM. Better yet, get 4. They run those programs great, and I think you'll be happy with them. Perfect for graphic design. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Photo tips coming up. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, coming to you from Silicon Valley. Well, really the most northern tip of Silicon Valley. Every weekend at this time on this radio station talking about technology. And you know, one of the things I like to do in this, you know, second half of each hour is bring on an expert, a guest expert in some topic. And we've covered everything from home theater to security to Windows to Mac to the Internet. But one thing we haven't covered is digital photography. And who better to do that than Chris Marquardt? He is the creator of the Tips from the Top Floor photography podcast, tipsfromthetopfloor.com, podcast award winner in 2005 and 2006 for a best educational podcast, but just really a great guy at explaining the ins and outs of digital photography. And I thought he could come in and give us some help, some expertise. All the way from Tübingen, Germany, Chris Marquardt. Hello, welcome.
Hey, Leo, how's it going?
It's going great. It's great to have you on. We met at the Podcast Expo a couple of years. No, I guess it was last year.
A couple of months ago in September.
You had that Nokia N93 that I was so jealous of. yeah, does yours still focus? Mine stopped focusing.
Mine still focuses quite well.
I must have mistreated it. I probably mistreated it. Oh, well. Let me ask you, first of all, you do the podcast is an English language podcast, but you do it from, you're German, you do it from Germany. Why in English?
Well, when I looked into the whole podcasting thing about 2 years ago, I just found that the German market wasn't quite there yet. So that basically was the basis for the decision.
And your English is, of course, perfect.
Thank you.
I mean, it's really good. So, but at the same time, I imagine there's some pressure now from folks in Germany to do it in German.
Well, I do a German podcast, actually, and it's also about photography, and I do that together with a co-host here.
What's that called?
I started that. That's happyshooting.de.
I like it. Okay. So you can go to, if you speak German, happyshooting.de, if you speak English, tips from the top floor. And why the top floor?
Well, when I started the whole thing, I used to live on the top floor of a five-story building. So
there you
it's
go.
That easy. Nothing mysterious about it.
So each time we talk, I'd like to do really basic stuff on photography. I mean, you cover everything on the show. I think it'd be useful for us to start at the beginning. Even somebody who takes a lot of pictures, as I do, can really learn some technique. Are you a professional photographer?
I am, yes.
So this is what you do for a living.
That's what I do for a living. I also do audio production, kind of a media kind of business here.
And what kind of photography do you like to do?
Well, portrait photography, product photography. I'm not that much into the landscape thing, but in all general types of photography, basically.
If you want to see some of Chris's great stuff, you can go to Tips from the Top Floor's gallery, and there's some great pictures there, some fun pictures, and some beautiful pictures. You shoot digitally exclusively now?
Exclusively digitally. Since 2003, when DSLRs kind of started to become affordable, that was the turning point for me, and I've never looked back.
And something I ask every expert, what camera are you using today?
I use a Canon 5D.
Ooh. Okay, now I'm going to drool. That's a nice microphone. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about composition today, because I think that's something right at the beginning, right at the start of photography, you've got to figure out how to frame your photo.
Right.
And I tell you, I think that's immediately the first thing you notice between somebody who's taking snapshots and really doesn't know what they're doing and somebody who knows what they're doing. You see a whole different picture.
Oh, yes, you do. I mean, the thing is, the camera can do a whole lot for you. The automatic settings are cool to get the exposure kind of right. But I like to compare that a bit to writing. Buying a good word processor doesn't really make you a good writer, and the same is true with a camera. So there is a technology part to it, but it's also very, very much about the person behind the camera. And image composition is an important subject here. So with many images that I see, especially from inexperienced photographers, you see the subject being bang in the middle. And I guess the name point and shoot camera kind of leads to that behavior. You just point, you shoot, and you end up having, a picture with the person in the middle or the subject in the middle. But you could try to make more use of the space that the image offers you.
You do. So, there's an excellent picture on your gallery that was actually taken with a camera phone, of all things. You're hiking, and it is a really good example of the subject really not being in the middle. There's a woman going down a path, and she's on the left, and to the right there's this beautiful waterfall. The only thing in the middle really is the railing. But it's a surprising picture because of the composite, because of the choices you make in there, and it makes and that makes it work.
Yeah, and sometimes when I tell people that they should move the subject out of the middle, they ask me, where should I move the subject? So that's where it's the infamous rule of thirds, or kind of like the abbreviation, the ROT.
The ROT. Okay. Tell me about the ROT.
Despite its name, it's not a rule. It's kind of a guideline, or I use it as an emergency exit to kind of, if I don't see a good composition jump at me, then I fall back to that. And basically you slice the image into three horizontal and vertical areas of the same size, kind of a tic-tac-toe grid kind of thing.
Okay.
And then you end up with those four points where those lines meet. And these are the more interesting points of the picture. So if you move head of the subject in a portrait onto one of those points, or if you shoot a landscape shot, try to get the horizon out of the middle onto one of those horizontal lines, just based on what you want to emphasize. If you want to emphasize on the ground, move the line, move the horizon, the horizon to the upper line, or if you want to emphasize the sky, move it down.
It makes perfect sense. And just if people want to see this picture, it's at tipsfromthetopfloor.com. It's an album 119, the world's largest cuckoo clock album. And I think in a way, this is a good example of rule of the thirds, because the subject really is clearly this woman who is exactly on one of those tic-tac-toe points.
Yes.
And there is, in fact, that railing is a line, one of the third. It's in the third of the line. I mean, you made this picture as almost a tic-tac-toe grid, and it really does show you, I guess, what you were thinking when you were composing it. Amazing, though. Yes. You were able to do that with a camera phone.
Well, it doesn't really matter. You can do it with, you don't even need a digital camera for it. You can do it with any camera. It's even, I mean, look back at painting. Old painters really use that technique a lot.
Right. Same thing with a cuckoo clock. It's not right smack dab in the middle. And I'd be tempted, frankly, if I were taking a picture of a cuckoo clock. Well, you think that this is the subject of the photo. Put it in the center.
Right.
But you want to, I guess you want to lead the eye around the picture a little bit.
And sometimes it can be really nice to have a subject right in the center, very symmetrical composition. But most of the time, the not so symmetrical things work a bit better.
The rule of thirds are rot. And Chris has a lot of good examples in his galleries, as well as his podcast, which I can't recommend more highly. I mean, it really is excellent. It's Tips from the Top Floor, the photography podcast, tipsfromthetopfloor.com. And as with any good podcast, it's really not just a bunch of instruction. It's entertaining. It's interesting. It's fun to hear, fun to listen to. Chris, we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leah.
Let's go on with the calls. Ruth's on the line from Hercules, California. Ruth, Leah Laporte.
Hi,
the tech
Leo.
Guy. Hey.
How are you doing?
Very well. Happy April Fool's Day.
Thank
anybody,
you.
Anybody play any pranks on you?
No, not yet.
Oh, you're lucky. I hate April Fool's Day. I keep getting bit by stories, and I go, oh, that's not true. What can I do for you?
I was wondering if you had a real-time or live backup solution that you could recommend for me.
When you say real-time, you mean...
corporations do that.
You mean all the time real-time? Like always going on in the background kind of thing?
Yeah. So if you're working on a document and something happens to either the hard drive or the power goes out,
right,
you'll have another copy either on a NAS or a USB hard drive that you can back up to.
Nothing that, for instance, a NAS or a USB hard drive is in true real time, in the sense that it will back it up, but it might do it every hour. So you might miss whatever you did in the last few minutes. The only real true instantaneous backup is RAID, where you have two drives in your machine, and as you write to one drive, the other one is copying it.
The only reason I can't do that is because we're working with a laptop.
Yeah, got
it. And we're not able to do RAID with two hard drives.
Let me think if there's anything that I know of that will, any software that would run all the time and back it up. No, nothing that I, nothing synchronous is really the word you want to use. Synchronous means at the same time. So at the same time as it's being written to one spot, it's being written to another spot. You'd think that Word would do that or something like that. I would suggest, there's Carbonite, our sponsor, and that works great. What you do is you would right-click on the folder that say the My Documents folder, and just say, hey, keep this backed up. And that is always running in the background, but it doesn't, it may take a little while before it gets to that changed file. And the nice thing about that is it's backing up online, which means it's off, in a secure server location somewhere completely different. Another way to do it would be to have a synchronization program and an external drive, or even it's not laptops. You can't have an internal second drive, but any second drive. And programs, there are a number of programs. There's Microsoft's own Sync Toy, and you could set it to run every 10 minutes. So you'd lose a minimum of data. And there's also the one I use for many years that I really like from Centered Systems called Second Copy. It's not free. SyncToy is free, but it doesn't have as many features as Second Copy does. That's secondcopy.com. And the same thing, you can have it automatically It's running as a service in the background, constantly backing it up. There will be a gap. I mean, if you have a crash, there will be a gap, but it might only be, you know, just a few minutes, which is, I think, probably in most cases, unless you want to spend a lot more money, that's sufficient.
Okay. Would that be the same as the Norton or the other?
Yeah, all of the folder synchronization programs. Yeah, they do roughly the same thing.
Where you schedule backups?
Actually, you know what? There is another choice. You're using XP or Vista?
Using XP.
Vista has an automated backup solution that does do this in real time. And on XP, there's a program called GoBack that is always backing up what you're doing. I should have thought of this. GoBack will do exactly what you want. GoBack is kind of like System Restore, but instead of just copying system files, it copies everything. And so you can always go back in time. So that was sold to Roxio, which then sold it to Symantec. And you can get it. I don't know if that's what you were talking about when you were talking about the Norton solution, but yeah, GoBack will do that. And they've built into Vista a very similar solution that I believe does exactly the same thing. So, yeah, what was I thinking? Of course you can do that. Thanks for the call. Leo, more calls coming up. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, your worst nightmare, a geek with his own radio show. I am the tech guy. So glad you're here. The website is techguylabs.com. That's where we've got notes about everything we talk about and links to the websites we mention and so forth. And of course, the chat room is there as well. techguylabs.com. Bob's in Culver City, California, listening on the great KFI. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Leo. How you doing?
Very well. How are you today?
Well, I'm frustrated and disappointed, never going to Fry's again.
You must be using technology.
I'm trying to.
That's what causes frustration.
Okay, yeah.
What happened? You bought something at Fry's that didn't work out?
Well, I bought a reconditioned compact Rosario.
There you go. We were talking last hour, I think, we were talking about refurbs. And I mentioned that it's fine to buy a refurb in a couple of it's narrow circumstances. If it is from the original manufacturer, if it's a current model, if they stand behind it with 100% warranty. Reconditioned, as you have learned now, Bob, is another thing. I've actually heard of Fry's. I don't know if this is true, but I've heard of Fry's taking busted hard drives and, quote, reconditioning them and reselling them.
I haven't heard.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't want to libel them, so I'm just saying that's I heard somebody told me that. I don't know that for a fact. But I have to say, whenever I hear reconditioned, I get very nervous.
Yeah, the problem is not the laptop itself as far as functioning is concerned.
Good.
It seems to be working really good. I just have to get used to the different size keyboard. And I've been using a regular keyboard on a desktop for, 20 years.
Right.
But what happens is when I bought it and took it home, I even charged the battery for one full day before I, turned the system on. I think that's a tremendous amount of self-control.
I'm going to tell you right now, lithium-ion batteries, the kind of batteries used in laptops, cameras, camcorders, cell phones, have a limited number of charge cycles. Not very many, around 500. And once they've gone to that point, they're gone. They're not going to, you can't use them again. You just needed to buy a new battery on that. That reconditioned laptop, they didn't replace the battery.
Well, what happened is about 5 weeks into using it, it's like the battery disconnected.
It's exactly what happens. It fails suddenly.
Yes.
It's exactly what happens, and that's after a certain number of charges. You've got a limited number of charge cycles on a lithium-ion battery.
When I went back to Fry's, jumping up and down, they said, well, it's outside of our warranty. You have to contact Compaq and so on and so forth. And anyway, what they did before I started crying out loud, was they gave me a $30 discount on a 12-cell, a brand-new 12-cell
okay.
Hewlett-Packard replacement batteries.
Okay.
That lasted about 5 more weeks.
Oh, dear.
And then just flat stopped. The computer will work fine if
I don't
have
think Fry's sold
AC.
You. I don't think Fry's sold you a new battery. I think they sold you a used, another reconditioned battery.
Well, I went and took it off the wall myself, and it was still in the factory.
Wow. Because I mean, that one is at least under warranty. You should take it back. Say the battery stopped working. I don't think it's your laptop because it worked for a while. If there were a problem with the charging circuitry, it wouldn't have worked at all. I think it's really a problem with the batteries.
Okay.
You just got another bad one. But the good news is you bought it new. I would say exchange it.
Okay, I'll go. Yeah, back I don't think that during the week.
Yeah, I don't think the laptop's doing anything to the battery to make it stop working. Here's another tip that I didn't know about. My friend Steve Gibson did a lot of research on lithium ion batteries. The best way to store them is not fully charged or fully discharged, but just with a little bit of a charge on them. There's no memory effect. Remember they used to say on NiCads, you got to be very careful. You know, it will remember how much you used it, and it'll go, and that'll become its capacity. So you shouldn't charge it till it's fully discharged. That's not true. Not true with nickel metal hydride or with lithium ion. They don't have. There's no memory effect. So that whole thing of deconditioning, you know, reconditioning a battery by discharging it fully and recharging it doesn't do anything for lithium ion. In fact, it shortens the life because they have a limited lifespan. Alan North Hollywood, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hi, Alan.
Oh, hi. Hi,
welcome.
Leo.
What can I do for you today?
Well, I have a Palm Pilot, Tungsten T3.
Ah, nice. Those were great. I love those.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a very nice device. And it will sync with a Windows XP system that I have.
Right.
If I run it through the USB port.
Okay.
But to be able to get it to synchronize without the USB connection, I got an infrared IRDA to USB converter.
Oh.
And I put that on there.
Okay.
And the driver for the device says that there is a there is an infrared device.
Well, there isn't. Now, remember, it's a converter, so the computer will never see an infrared device. It sees it as a USB device.
Right. But the USB driver says that there is a, you know, a little program comes up. And it says there is one infrared source present or something like that.
Okay.
So it detects the palm.
Right.
When I go to sync with it, the palm says that the USB device is being occupied by another...
Boy, you know, I have no idea. Remember, the palm thinks it's on infrared. The computer thinks it's on USB. So use the infrared to sync with the palm. And frankly, you'll be disappointed with the speed of infrared anyway. It's not as fast as a USB. I know it seems more desirable not to have the cables, but I would just stick with the USB, frankly. I am out of time, but you know what? I'm going to come back and do this again next week, and I hope you will too. The website's there for your delectation and pleasure, techguylabs.com, all week long. And don't forget, I've got lots of podcasts, 10 shows a week at twit.tv. I'll see you next time. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.